How is it that we find ourselves surrounded by such complexity, such elegance?
The genes of you and me,
the genes of you and me,
we're all made of DNA. We're all made of the same chemical DNA.
Hello, you're listening or watching DNA Today. We are a genetics podcast and radio show. I'm your host, Kira Dineen. I'm also a certified genetic counselor practicing in the prenatal space. On this show, we explore genetics' impact on our health through conversations with leaders in genetics. These are experts like genetic counselors, researchers, doctors, and patient advocates. My guest today is Giordano Botta. He is a biologist and bioinformatician. Giordano earned a PhD in public health. He has extensive experience in analysis of large genomic data sets, including a publication in Nature. He is a co-founder and CEO of Allelica, which created a software to help clinical genetics labs to perform polygenic risk score analysis. In this episode, we're going to be exploring polygenic risk score, which is something that I've wanted to explore, I'd say, for a couple years on the show. So thanks so much for coming on and sharing your expertise in this area.
Thank you for having me. Pleasure to be here.
So let's start out with just defining what is a polygenic risk score, because I think it's become a buzzword in genetics, but some people may not understand, like, well, what does that exactly mean? Like, what is a polygenic risk score, which we might refer to as PRS throughout the interview, but go ahead and define that for us.
Yeah, so polygenic risk score is a way to assess the genetic risk of developing a disease. So we can also differentiate a polygenic risk score with the polygenic score, because polygenic score can be used to predict a trait such as height, while polygenic risk score have been built specifically to predict disease risk. And is a weighted sum of genetic variants. You know that polygenic risk score can be built using just few variants up to millions of variants. So there is a very large diversity in how we can build a polygenic risk score. And the most important thing to remember is the a weighted sum, because each variant used in the score has a different weight. And then we need to multiply the weight for how many alleles at each variant a person has. For example, it's a heterozygote, homozygote for that effect allele. So we call it effect allele.
So there's a lot of data that goes into this, because unlike other testing where maybe you're finding, oh, there's one change in a gene and this could have this effect, and you're looking at one change, this, you're compiling so many changes into one to talk about an effect. So it's very different from a lot of other genetic testing that people think about when we say, oh, there's a mutation. This is like many of those combine. So knowing that, how are polygenic risk scores empowering the next generation of clinical genomics? I mean, this is where we're headed for the future. I think once we heard polygenic risk scores were, you know, becoming a thing, people are like, wow, this is really going to change genomics. How do you see it changing genomics, you know, in the next few years, decade?
Yeah, I think that mainly is because polygenic risk score is adding a new layer of information to the what we are using till a few years ago in clinical genomics, because it is adding the information of using polymorphisms, so common variants that are not errors in our genetic code, such as the mutations. So the common variants, polymorphisms, they do not cause a protein to function in an altered way, or they do not cause, they're not errors. So, and for example, polymorphisms are the genetic variants that can code for different eye color or different morphological traits that we have between different people. And so adding this new layer, it's possible to have a much more precise estimate of the genetic risk of developing diseases, but also to explain the genetic component of the disease. And till a few years ago, this layer of information, so the use of common variants, has been neglected. And also for a good reason, because we haven't had the data to be able to identify the contribution of those variants and also to validate the contribution of these variants, because it's extremely important to start identifying the variants and then validate the predictive power of the score that we can build in prospective studies. And now, thanks to the very large genomics data set that are available since just a few years, we were able to use the results from GWAS, so from association studies, and model different forces that act on the genome to identify these scores and then validate their predictive performance in clinical data sets.
So what kind of conditions can a polygenic risk score be calculated for? We've been talking about what a polygenic risk score is, how it works, but how can we actually apply that to human health?
Yeah, so potentially we can calculate polygenic risk score to any trait or disease that we have genetics data, because we can also build a score using a few individuals, but this won't have any meaningful predictive power in a clinical setting. So I would like to stress that there is a problem in polygenic risk score, that is the generalization. Sometimes people talk about polygenic risk score is not predictive enough or cannot be used into the clinic, but without describing the use case. And for example, in the polygenic score catalog, that is a fantastic resources where scientists can upload polygenic score, there are more than 1,000 of different score. But then just few have the predictive power that can add something to what we already do in medicine, because polygenic risk score is when we want to add a new innovation, new technology, and especially in the genetic assessment of the disease, we want to understand how much this new technology add to what is already in place, what is already existing. And some score, they do not add anything. Because they can, for example, identify an increased risk just of 10%, 20% of a disease that has a prevalence of, for example, 5%. So knowing to have 5.5% risk of disease is not interesting at all. While for other diseases, we have a polygenic risk score that can identify individuals at fourfold risk of disease. This starts to be relevant into the clinic.
For some conditions, we see that it's changing risk a little bit, but not enough to change what we do clinically or anything to change in someone's life with management. But for others, you're saying, I mean, a 3 or 4 increase, like fold risk for that, maybe there is something to do in those cases. But I think as time goes on, we're going to learn more about more and more variants that play a role in that and being able to identify people. So I guess that's what's changing over time, is just how many variants that we understand with genomics. PerkinElmer Genomics is a global leader in genetic testing focusing on rare diseases, inherited disorders, newborn screening, and hereditary cancer. Testing services support the full continuum of care from preconception and prenatal to neonatal, pediatric, and adult. Testing options include sequencing for targeted genes, multiple genes, the whole exome or genome, and copy number variations. Using a simple saliva or blood sample, PerkinElmer Genomics answers complex genetic questions that can proactively inform patient care and end the diagnostic odyssey for families. Learn more at PerkinElmerGenomics.com. Have you done a genetic test and discovered you have a mutation or pathogenic variant, as we genetic counselors call them? One of the next steps is to inform your family they are at risk of also carrying the variant. Telling relatives about their risk can save lives, but these can also be tough conversations to have. Luckily, Connect My Variant offers resources to help, including ways to communicate results with suggested language. Whether you want to talk to your aunt or email a third cousin, Connect My Variant can help. You are not alone. Connect My Variant can connect you with others who have the same exact variant. Growing a network of people with the exact same variant who know about it can help your family members understand the impact of your genetic variant and the steps for them to get tested and to prevent disease. If you want to discover where your variant came from and learn more about what it means for your family, explore and sign up at connectmyvariant.org. Again, that's connectmyvariant.org. Are you interested in the rapidly growing field of genetics and want to learn more about clinical genetics, molecular genetics, and laboratory science? Then you should check out the Genetic Assistant Online Training Program at Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine. By taking part in the program, you'll be joining both national and international learners with the same passion for genetics. Interact directly with your Johns Hopkins instructors and fellow students throughout the program. Applications are closing for the spring cohort, but there are still spots available for summer and fall 2022. For more information, use the link in our show notes if you're listening to this through a podcast app. You can also access the link at dnapodcast.com. Who would you say is the target market for this test? Who can benefit the most from polygenic risk scores at this point?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, potentially the target market is everyone, because we would like to know our genetic risk of developing diseases, especially when in the world where we live, where we have some guidelines that tell us to have a certain screening or to respect some threshold for some lipids for levels, for example. But this threshold, dates of timing of to initiate a screening have been based on the average, while people they have a very nice wide range of diversity, and also in how the risk increases over time. So potentially knowing to have an increased risk of prostate cancer or breast cancer at early age, when we can start to have a more frequent screening, can be extremely helpful. But then, of course, even here we need to contextualize, because potentially for some score we'll have some action that can be put in place to reduce the risk. For other ones, we just don't have anything to do. For example, for Alzheimer risk. So, we can mitigate the risk, but it's not something that there is a clear preventative path to put in place, especially at young age. While for breast cancer, potentially a screening, even starting at 25, 30 years of age, can capture the risk at the very, very beginning. So, but also there is a because when we add a new technology in medicine, especially, we need to be very careful in applying the technology in a pace that is not overwhelmed. Let's say does not overwhelm the practitioners, the physicians. So it's something that can be digested easily. So screening everyone potentially is the right thing to do for certain diseases. But the adoption into the clinic can be not be facilitated with test everyone approach, while we can identify some population that will need let's say more urgently a screening by polygenic risk score. This, for example, applies in coronary artery disease prevention, so the heart attack prevention, because the cardiologists, they already know that there are some people that are at intermediate risk, and they do not know if the best thing to do is to start a treatment or even like a more aggressive diet or also like a statin intervention, or to wait a little bit to see how the risk will progress. And that is where a polygenic risk score can really make the difference, because it can let a physician start the therapy earlier or let them wait a bit more.
That's a fantastic point of, for those people in the intermediate range, saying, okay, well, you know, are you high risk? Are you not? Whereas a polygenic risk score gives that extra data point, or many data points, I guess, so that physicians, healthcare providers say, oh, now this does put you into the high risk category, or now actually we see you're a little bit more in the low risk, and to be able to change that management. And as you said, I think breast cancer is a great example of that as well, because people may start screening like mammograms, breast MRIs, et cetera, earlier. You know, certainly sometimes I'm sitting with patients and there's a family history of breast cancer. I'm not a cancer genetic counselor, but, you know, certainly comes up with family history. And, you know, information like this could help patients in that position to say, okay, should I start this early? Should I look at prevention for breast cancer and even Alzheimer's that you mentioned. You know, for that right now, there's nothing we can do, but certainly that's probably going to change in the future as we learn more about, you know, more conditions in the neurology space. And even people planning their lives, if they know they're at a higher risk, maybe they'll have different plans. Maybe they'll, you know, have their finances be a little bit different if they can see that. So I think even outside of the scope of like direct medicinal intervention, there's also that just global like life's, you know, scale, I guess. Looking at how this process actually works, because we see how important it is and how useful it can be. How does it work? If someone has, say, they've already done genetic testing, they have a genotype, how does it work? Can they upload it? What does the process look like for healthcare providers?
Because this is a clinical test, especially where we work with a clinical genetics lab, that they, first of all, they develop an LDT. So it's a laboratory developed test. So they're in a CLIA CAP environment. So there are a series of validation to perform, and depends on the technology used. If it's a microarray or a low coverage whole genome sequencing, it was also an interesting part of PRS is that we do need a thorough assessment of the genome, because we cannot rely only on exomes, because the majority of variants are in intergenic region, in a regulatory region, like in promoter and enhancer. So we really need to have an understanding of the genome also in non-coding regions. And then, it can be used, the low coverage whole genome sequencing. So sequence the genome at 1x coverage rather than 30x. So this decreases the prices a lot and makes this test affordable for almost everyone. And once the preferred technology has been chosen, there is a set of validation process to put in place. And then the lab upload the genetics data, the raw genetics data, and then our software performs the entire pipeline up to the reporting. Usually we work with the clinical genetics lab to customize the report, because each lab has its own tone of voice, or they want to have the report just for physicians, or one report for physician and one report for the individual tested. But the main steps in performing a polygenic risk score analysis is the quality control of the raw data, and then imputation, because we can impute common variants. So since we use common variants, we can infer what are the variants even using panels that can allow the assessment of the genome at like millions of variants using this inexpensive technology.
Do you want to connect with other people who have the same genetic variant as you? You should check out Connect My Variant. It's an online resource that allows you to do just that. Connect My Variant also provides different avenues of informing your family of possible inherited risk of disease. This includes helping find where your genetic variant came from and finding distant cousins that may also be at risk. The University of Washington has supported the Connect My Variant project in an effort to help patients and families understand where their genetic variants come from. Check it out at connectmyvariant.org. Are you a student seeking out genetic assistant positions? These vital positions aid with clinical and research patient communication, data entry, genetic testing coordination, and administrative tasks. Therefore, training is key. We recommend the Genetic Assistant Online Training Program at Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine. This online program provides knowledge and skills to learners considering genetic assistant positions or those recently hired to these roles who need job training. The program consists of two 10-week instructor-led courses. All you need is a basic understanding of science, particularly biology. At the successful completion of the program, learners will receive a certificate of completion from the Johns Hopkins School of Medicine and the McCusick-Nathans Department of Genetic Medicine. Applications are closing for the spring cohort, but there's still spots available for the summer cohort starting June 6th and the fall cohort starting September 12th. A limited number of partial tuition waivers are now available to offset the cost of the program. Don't wait. Check out the Genetic Assistant Online Training Program at Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine now. Click the link in the show notes for this episode for more information. You can also access the link via the blog post for this episode, available at dnapodcast.com. Did you know PerkinElmer Genomics was one of the first laboratories to offer whole genome sequencing on a clinical basis? whole genome sequencing can maximize clinical diagnostic yield for patients. With a turnaround time of 6 weeks, PerkinElmer's whole genome sequencing test is designed to provide access to additional valuable information compared to an exome. PerkinElmer Genomics provides one of the world's most comprehensive programs for detecting clinically significant genomic changes. PerkinElmer Genomics delivers knowledge that can empower health. PerkinElmer is a global leader committed to innovating for a healthier world. Join their mission at PerkinElmerGenomics.com. And also, stay tuned for our interview with PerkinElmer, where we're going to be exploring the power of whole genome sequencing. I'll also tease that my guest for this episode is a world-renowned geneticist, so you are not going to want to miss this one. But while you wait for the episode, head over to PerkinElmerGenomics.com to start discovering all PerkinElmer has to offer. So when it comes to sequencing with it, you mentioned, you know, there's different levels of it where sometimes we're sequencing an area or the whole genome multiple times that we're really confident on the sequence of it. So like the letters of the genome. And you said that can be expensive the more you do it, obviously. So if you're doing it less, does that affect the accuracy of the sequence? If you're doing, that's called the depth, right? When you're doing either one time or 30 times, does that affect how accurate it can be?
Not in this case, because we leverage the genomes of the community, let's say, of the population. So because since we have very large databases with many genomes sequenced at high coverage, we can reconstruct the part that we are more uncertain, because the each generation the genome has the variants are associated between one to the other one, because recombination it happens in one chromosome at a time, so it does not break the entire haplotype, so the genetic variation are associated among them. So there are statistical way to reconstruct this haplotype with a very high confidence, but that's why because we assess common variants. We cannot assess rare variants because, of course, are rare, so we do not have the representation in this reference panel. While with common variants, we can identify exactly that haplotype that's been passed and is circulating among people. This is also very fascinating because it lets us understand how related we are to each other in terms of being human beings.
Right, that this is how the ancestry genetic testing works as well. You're kind of looking at the same type of testing that we've been talking about with like polymorphisms and those variants. And just speaking of that, for people that are of non-European descent, there's a huge divide in terms of how good we are at giving them genetic information that is equal to people of European descent. So as you said, like reference genomes and like our data sets are primarily of European descent. So when it comes to people that are not, there's not as much to compare it to. So you do have this disparity there that we've highlighted on many episodes of this show. How is Alelica addressing this in terms of like polygenic risk score? Because certainly that has an overlap, because you're looking at lots of common variants that we've been talking about. This is a problem in the field overall. But with Alelica, how are you addressing it?
Okay. So first of all, we validated the scores in each of the measure ancestry. So in Africans, East Asians, South Asian, Latin Americans. And doing this validation allow us to understand what is the risk conferred by each percentile of the polygenic risk score. And so we can provide calibrated polygenic risk score. So calibrated means that the risk that we provide, we return to an individual, is indeed the risk corresponding to that ancestry. So we have ancestry-specific risk prediction. And so this is the first part, validating what has been built with the European data set. in non-European populations and understand the risk prediction, if it's meaningful or not, if it's possible to identify individuals at elevated risk that are that is useful to use into the clinic or not. And then we are also applying and developing new models that what they do is to try to understand what are the causal variants. And these are called fine mapping methods. And these methods are extremely important because the main problem is that to identify a polygenic risk score, we use GWAS to train the model. And these GWAS, they rely on tagging variants. So usually the largest signal that we identify is not the causal variance, but is the variance that is called linkage with the causal. So the variant associated with the causal, because often we do not have genotyped the causal variants because also the GWAS are not based on whole genome sequencing. They are based on microarray and then imputation. There are some limitation on that, but also because there is a lot of noise. So since the variants are associated, it's difficult to capture the causal. So what happens that when we apply polygenic risk score developed with the Europeans, GWAS in Europeans, we can use the tagging variants because they are extremely associated with the causal. But when we try to apply in other ancestry, the linkage disequilibrium pattern, so the association pattern between variants changes. So the variant that was a linkage with the causal is not a linkage anymore with the causal in another population. So we are just adding noise. And this is extremely important to assess, to understand if we want to develop a polygenic risk score that are portable between different populations. And then what we would like to tell is that we do not believe that the way to go is to have just one polygenic risk score that performs in all the different ancestries, because we will never have something that performs well if we do not take into account and embrace diversity, because different ancestries, they do have different features. And we have to celebrate this diversity rather than try to flatten it down and say, we are all the same. We are not. We have some differences. That's the beauty of any living creature. So we do have to address this and identify what is the best model for that particular ancestry. Also because there are some differences also in the underlying biology of the disease, the physiology of the disease. And for example, now we are seeing some risk models that are already used into the clinic. For example, the pool cohort equation, that is a model to assess the risk of heart attack and other cardiovascular diseases. They have added the ethnicity of individuals, such for example, a African, or but it is self-reported. And while they are increasing the predictive power because they have different betas in the model, so they have different effect. So because each variable, each risk factor has a different effect in different ancestral groups. But then this is based on self-reported ancestry. And this is a big problem because does not always correlate with the real ancestry that an individual has for different reasons. There's an interesting example of the Wisdom trial. This is a clinical trial where they're assessing the use of polygenic risk score in the breast cancer screening, where participants withdrawn their consent to participate because she felt that was not the risk was not addressed in the proper way, because she at the question which ancestral group she belongs to, she flagged the Hispanic ancestral group because she had a Spanish origin. So she thought that Hispanic related with that. But then when a Wisdom trial added a new polygenic risk score for Hispanic, And they changed their risk, but then they realized that she was from Spain and was not Hispanic as intended as Central America. And so she said, wait a minute, you changed my risk 2-3 times and something's wrong going on. But just to tell that self-reported ancestry is really problematic. In fact, what we do as a first step to build a PRS report is to assess the ancestry of an individual. And we have two options, one to return the ancestry report, one to do not that, for example, if someone does not want to know, because this can be also be considered kind of an incident finding as well, because potentially can they understand many different things on from the ancestry of an individual. But this is fundamental to calculate the ancestry from a genomics data to build a PRS report.
It's interesting because I've even heard of this more happening in other areas of genetics as well, of not going by self-reported ancestry, because as you said, sometimes that is different from their genetic ancestry. So I see this as being an area that's really going to be, you know, expanding, where we're coming up with their genetic ancestry is, you know, part of the testing, and maybe not reporting that to them, because as you said, that could be an incidental finding of maybe they don't want to know that their family history is not what they thought, but that it is medically relevant when we're going to analyze this genetic data. Before we end, I did have one more question that I wanted to learn a little more about. So there is a percentile of polygenic risk score, which I'm hearing is kind of useless, and it's more about the absolute risk that matters. Can you kind of explain those two and how we should be using them before we wrap up here?
Sure, absolutely. Because one big problem is also how to use a quantitative risk factor in genetics, because it's a score. So people can have like, and usually is normally distributed, and we divide it in percentiles. So the main problem is that the risk conferred by polygenic risk score at each percentile is not correlated with the percentile. So it's not that the risk increases linearly with the increase of the percentile. So tell in the report that someone has a 82% is at the 82 percentile of the PRS can cause many problems, because first he thinks, okay, I have my risk is 82. I have the risk greater than 82% of the population, so it's something that I should be worried of. And also, 82% can be confused with the actual risk of developing the disease. But the interesting thing is that the risk increases in many different ways. So, for example, we can have a jump of the risk at the very end of the distribution. So the risk can stay quite flat and then jump just at the 95th percentile. And the absolute risk, that can be lifetime risk, 10-year or 5-year risk, increases crossing the threshold just at 97th percentile, for example. And so it is extremely important to know the risk conferred by the PRS, not just relying on the percentile, assuming that if someone is at the 90 percentile, his risk is has any meaningful clinical application. And also, we can think about it like, for example, if you sort, let's say the size of some fruits, let's say that needs to fit in a box, we can have a range of fruits that can fit in a box. Potentially, they are just a little bit different in one to another one, but until they fit in a box, there is no any reason why we need to consider this difference in size relevant. And so it is the same. So since the people, they have differential risk up to a certain point where they do not fit, let's say, in the box, but they, because they have the risk higher than a threshold. So now we need to intervene, but just after the risk crossed the threshold. And that's how medicine works. We need to put some threshold. In the future, there will be like more sophisticated method that will address the individual differences at each of this risk of distribution. But now we need to be more close, let's say, how the medicine work. And now the medicine work with a certain threshold, putting some threshold. The threshold that we need to rely on are those that are present in the guideline. While we develop better model, we need to stick with something that is already used in the practice.
And I think that's important for healthcare providers to understand. And I know Lilica really focuses on that, so that healthcare providers understand, okay, this is what the data is telling us, and this is how you should be using this in terms of clinical management. Be sure to enter our giveaway on social media. Win a free enrollment to a 3-hour course in the Alelica PRS Clinical Academy, covering the research behind polygenic risk scores to clinical applications. You can enter by looking for our post on Twitter, LinkedIn, Instagram. It's going to be a video clip from this episode. And this has been posted on January 21st, the day this episode comes out, at 9 a.m. Eastern Time. And the giveaway is going to end on February 4th, 2022. So be sure to enter before then. Thank you so much for coming on the show, Dr. Bogota. There's so much to polygenic risk scores. I feel like we could go on for like 2 hours. but I think there's just so much to learn in this space. And people can learn more by going to alelica.com. And you can also learn more about the show by going to dnapodcast.com. You can follow us on social media, Twitter, Instagram, YouTube, Facebook. Connect with us there by searching DNA Today. And any questions for myself, Dr. Bogota, you can send into info@dnapodcast.com. And I would really appreciate if you could rate and review on Apple Podcasts. That's how we're going to reach new listeners and find other genetic nerds like yourself listening. So thank you again for coming on the show. Really appreciate hearing all about polygenic risk scores today.
Thank you, Kira. Thank you for listening.
Thanks for listening, everybody. Join us next time to learn and discover new advances in the world of genetics.
The genes of you and me, the genes of you and me, we're all made of DNA. We're all made of the same chemical DNA.